clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights,
or the bride with the guy on the side,
or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment.
This one is a Lollapalooza. Unashamed. And if you guys don't know Hell in 12 Trees, what a riot. Unashamed. Yeah. And Monroe, what's his name? Monroe
Owsley.
And Robert Young were in this.
Yeah.
And I thought the relationship between him and Hell in 12 Trees was really gross. Her brother.
Yeah.
They're kissing on the lips. He's dancing with his sister. He asks his fiance, oh, are you jealous? And she says, that's your sister. I'm not jealous. But she is out on the town and she spends a night with the bad boy. And she comes home and, you know, the brother gets so outraged that she spent the night with this man because daddy-o won't let them get married. He shoots them. The unwritten law. And so, you know, it's just they. And then to save her, because first she doesn't want to save her brother. She becomes like this flashy man. She, all of a sudden she comes into court chewing gum, yum, yum, and she's wearing like, you know, trashy clothes. I'm like, I don't care. And she becomes, they say, you know, you're going to have to be this horrible person to let your brother be free. And that was the end of that. But I thought that one was a riot.
And she's another one of those people who didn't survive the production code. She was so much a product of movies like Unashamed that there was no transition for her. She was kind of done.
She did Millie. I actually liked Millie as well.
Yeah. There's a number of them, but she's one of the sort of sacrifices of the production code. They just sort of, the movies they had made were no longer being made, and they didn't find a new place, which now I'm getting ahead of myself because that's one of the chapters coming up. But
yes. Yeah. Also, I'd like to talk about Female with Ruth Chatterton.
Yeah.
That movie makes me mad.
Well, that's one, it's one of the best in some ways where you've got the portrait of a powerful woman living like a man who's having sex with the employees, and they're all sort of groveling, and she has no time for emotion. She just wants the revolving door in her bedroom, and anyone who deals with emotion is transferred out of the company. I mean, she's ruthless in terms of sex. But the problem with Female is the cop-out ending. That one has a very sort of code-like ending of her giving it all up when she meets the right man who essentially can tame her. And so
Was that George Brent?
Yeah,
was
George
he
Brent.
Her husband at the time?
I believe he was at the time, yes. And so that one is really good to the last 5 minutes or so.
Yes, so she gives him all the power. Okay.
Yeah, it's a gyp.
It was great until she gives him the power. And I was like, geez, Louise, couldn't they do that? I wish there was something else. Okay, so now we're on Hollywood's Crash Course, More Than Just Escapism, 1931-1934.
Well, we've been mentioning the Depression a little bit, but what's interesting about the Hollywood depictions of the Depression is we talk about the escapism, but there's also that other stuff going on, the realism, that they really did embrace that with the gangster movies and the movies about youth in America. That very, very depressing movie, Wild Boys of the Road, which I included
in
the chapter.
Yeah.
I mean, it has an upbeat ending, but it's pretty tough all the way through of watching these bad things happen to sweet teenagers just trying to survive. And the Busby Berkeley Warner Brothers movies are very interesting because I include Gold Diggers of 1933. And it's fascinating because it's both kind of movies. It's a sort of realistic depression movie because you always feel like these Corrines in the show are like two steps from the pavement. If the show closes, they're all going to be on the street and working the street. So there's this sort of reality at the back door that's always present. And yet when you get into the numbers, you're in this fairyland of pure escapism. But the most interesting thing is the Remember My Forgotten Man number, which combines both of those things in one thing, which is about the thing we were talking about with the World War I veterans, how they were treated. And it's got to be the most, it's the grimmest movie musical number I can probably think of. And yet it combines that incredible film artistry and that sort of lavish Berkeley imagination allied to this very serious, very, very sad issue. And so how they was able to balance that escapism and realism in dealing with the Depression is kind of an amazing feat.
Yes, I think so. I agree with you. There's this one. Okay. Gabriel Over the White House. What a film. You guys got to check this one out. You want to talk about that one?
It's got to be one of the nuttiest things ever to come out of MGM. And a U.S. president who's sort of touched by an angel and sort of wants to do good and starts doing good and then sort of turns into a dictator.
Anytime.
And I think you can interpret it in many different ways. And I think any group can sort of say it's speaking to their ideology because he touches on almost everything and he makes sort of transitions as the movie proceeds. But mostly it's just so odd that they would make a movie with, you just can't believe you're watching this movie.
It was fascinating. I know.
It's absolutely fascinating. Yes. It's a real curiosity. And I highly recommend it without actually saying I would call it a good movie. I would just say it was sort of daring and it's unique and worth a look, definitely, but sort of truly bizarre.
It'll make you go, huh? And, you know, yeah, there's a Franchotone is his, you know, law enforcer. They get the mob and they don't give him a trial. They don't get lawyers. They don't get anything. They just get killed. And it's just, you know, it is. It's a very, like, where are you going here, you guys? Is he good? Is he, what's up with that? So it's kind of weird.
It's extremely weird, but
I must see. Check it out. Yes, not a long film. It's a very interesting film. Okay. Employees' Entrance. That's a good one.
That's a good one, because that's a good sort of in the Joan Crawford arena of the department store employees, but this time it's Loretta Young, and it's Warner Brothers. But again, that whole world of how important it is to have a job in Depression America, just how if you lose that job, there may not be another one. And so it's sort of like it's like a war movie, even though it's set in a department store, because it is action packed. It is there's danger around every corner.
Suicide.
It's wildly
sex.
Eventful. And sweet Loretta Young sleeping with the boss.
Who is that wonderful sleazy guy,
Warren Williams,
who was wonderful. In those
so it's just got, it has an urgency you don't expect from just an ordinary department store movie, melodrama. It's sort of the department store, it's a life and death situation.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's so much, you know, so much stuff going on, all these like sub stories. And it's an interesting story. And you have any others you want to talk about? Are you fading out on me? I hear a boom boom.
Oh, no, I'm still here. I think He Was Her Man is the last one in that chapter, which is Joan Blondell and Jimmy Cagney. Again, a movie with no reputation, but I think it's an unsung gem of the mid-30s. And again, it's sort of lost souls finding each other, but it might be too late. And she sort of becomes a mail order bride. He's a sort of gangster on the run. And they meet accidentally, and it's probably going to be too late for them. But again, it has that sort of depression tinge of just sadness and sort of fatalism, and which is probably why it wasn't a hit, maybe. I don't know. But they're both wonderful in it, and as they were in so many things.
He said, I was talking to the author who wrote about George Raft, and you know, Jimmy Cagney said he loved two women in his life. One was his wife, and the other was Joan Blondell, because he worked with her so much, and they were pals.
Yeah, and I've
never seen this movie.
Together.
I gotta find it.
It's the last one they did of that run of things they did together, and it's especially fun especially interesting after Footlight Parade, which is so much fun, to see them in this very serious mode, and they're both really, really fine.
They do great. They're a really nice team together. They were great.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess we'll go to Mandatory Makeovers 34 and 38. What do you mean by that?
Well, I hinted at this, that when the production code comes in and you suddenly can't have all those movies about prostitution and the violence in the gangster movies at that level that it was at, and you couldn't have sin going unpunished. Mm-hmm. So many actresses who'd made their bread and butter, like Helen Twelvetrees or Dorothy McHale or Anne Harding, a lot of them didn't find vehicles to reinvent themselves for this sort of new movie world. Now, the ones who soared, went bigger than ever, were the ones who had a knack for comedy, because we were about to enter screwball comedy and the great age of romantic comedy. And so people like Myrna Loy and Claudette Colbert and Irene Dunne, Carol Lombard, who'd been around in the pre-Co era,
got
bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got bigger and bigger because they found a format, a formula or a style that suited them even better. Loretta Young is another one with really light comedy becoming her meat and potatoes. So they kind of soared, and others fell by the wayside who just never found that particular vehicle to sort of take them to the next place.
Sorry. And you know what's sad? When I read about these women, because I'll go to IMDb if I'm not familiar who they are, so many of them have tragic, very early endings.
Sure.
Death,
sure.
Suicide, alcoholism, this and that. And it's very sad, but, you know.
Of course.
What are they going to do?
I know. Helen Twelvetrees, she did commit suicide. Who's an interesting figure in this chapter is Jean Harlow, because you would assume she would be a casualty of the code because she was one of the racier of all those women playing, you know, gold diggers and call girls and prostitutes and scheming secretaries and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So what is she going to do? But MGM was successful with, particularly with Libeled Lady and...
Oh, I love that.
Wife versus Secretary, which is the one I include. If Wife versus Secretary had been made in the early 30s, she would have broken up the marriage and gotten Clark Gable. But in this, she's basically Little Miss Wonderful. She has a crush on him, but she's going to try to help their marriage. And it's very pre-code Jean Harlow. And yet she made it work, and the audience bought her in that. So she, even though she died the next year so young, she looked like she'd carved a niche for herself as we were moving forward. So she was a success story. Mae West wasn't really, because her kind of movie just could never be what it was anymore. But the most interesting figure, I think, is Maureen O'Sullivan, who was not a major star, but I include Tarzan Escapes in this because it's so interesting to have an actress play a character twice in the pre-code era and then four times in the code era. And it's really very different, even though it's the same woman, it's the same role, it's the same co-star. But those first two movies are essentially about a beautiful English rose who kind of unlocks her wild side.
Yeah, with her Tarzan.
She goes primal and casts off her former life and lives wild in the jungle with a guy who's practically naked. And that's what those first two movies are about. But then the other four, it kind of flips and you feel like they're about Jane domesticating Tarzan, and they have the perfect treehouse with the running water and the the elephant operated elevator, and it's sort of like they're turned. She's turned everything into a version, even though she's English, but a version of America, and it's the opposite of what the first two movies are. And they managed to make, again, the audience, I don't even think noticed, it just happened, and that was a successful transition from pre-code to code.
Is that when Boy came around?
Boy comes in the second one in the code.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was already, you know, they were already fine by then in terms of having made the rather odd transition.
Yeah, those first movies, it just made me, you know, like after Jane and Tarzan got it on, Jane's waking up like, oh, ecstasy, her arms. I'm like, oof.
Yeah.
Tarzan is a hunk. I got to give him that. Johnny Weissmuller, hubba hubba.
Yeah.
And Jane was very nice, but she didn't really do so much afterwards, I guess, because she had a lot of children.
She had a lot, yeah. She did retire for a while and then came back as a sort of middle-aged actress and then even as an older actress. But she, I don't think she was ever very happy playing Jane. But she did manage to get in a couple of, you know, she was in The Barons of Wimpole Street and The Thin Man and Pride and Prejudice. But she probably had to fight for some of those because they were content to have her hang around as Jane.
Literally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you've got, you know, I just watched Wife versus Secretary last night. One of the things they did with Jean was they darkened her blonde hair. It was no longer platinum anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess she seemed less sort of, slutty Jean of the early 30s, with the dye, hair dye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have the Thin Man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Myrna Loy's transition, because she played a lot of sort of loose ladies, too, in the early 30s.
She
and
did.
Then suddenly with the Thin Man, she's the perfect wife, which is that's a pretty big transition. But again, it secured her for the next several decades, and she had a whole new persona that stuck. And she did beautifully with it.
She really did. I mean, she could. I loved her and William Powell, and I thought they were a great team. But I loved her. You know, I'm getting ahead of myself because we're going to talk about some other the stories. But you know, she was really great, and I am a total William Powell fan. I adore him. And in Live a Lady, one of the funniest things he did in himself is him fishing and getting stuck in that water and doing that whole thing. And he was hysterical. And I also read that Jean wanted the part of Myrna Loy so she could be, you know, the love interest of the man whom she was in love with, which was William Powell. But I love him too. And then you have My Man Godfrey. Again,
as I said, because Carol Lombard was a star in a way she'd never been in the pre-code era. One screwball comedy happened to her first with 20th Century and then even more so with My Man Godfrey. And then she was a superstar after having been someone who easily could have been a casualty of those early years if the right kind of vehicle hadn't, again, unlocked the potential that she had that people weren't making use of.
Yeah, she was fabulous, and I loved her so much. And My Man Godfrey, of course, her ex-husband, William Powell, who they remained friends. They were only married for 2 years. And somehow I read that she helped him get the gig. I know that William had cancer, and he didn't tell anybody. He had rectal cancer, and they you know, put things in. He became okay. I don't know if that was the reason, but I love that movie. And then there's The Awful Truth.
Yeah, and again, Irene Dunne was another one after, you know, things like Backstreet and Ann Vickers. She could have gone the Ann Harding route and just been someone from soap operas who faded away. But once she did Theodora Goes Wild, followed immediately by The Awful Truth, it was like, God, she is brilliantly funny. And, you know, she never had to look back or doubt her career for the next, you know, 15 years in movies. She was beloved. And I think those two movies are what solidified her from there on.
She was great. And, you know, she did a lot. I mean, geez, Ann Vickers. Wow. That was a really heavy duty movie. She got pregnant by two different men. And she was unmarried. She had an abortion.
That's about as pre-code as you get. That's right up there with Faithless,
And she got the good ending that, you know, Walter Houston gets out of the slammer. So she has her happy ending. But that's like, wow. I liked her, The Awful Truth. The other one she did with Cary Grant, what was that, My Favorite Wife?
Yeah, My Favorite Wife. And then the soap opera, Penny Serenade, they did too.
I like that too.
Awful Truth is the best one, though, I think. Yeah.
Yes, I love when she meets his fiance's family.
Yes, that's
the blowing
classic.
In the wind. Okay,
that's a classic.
Now we're at the biopics, 1936, 1946.
Well, I wanted to write in this chapter, there have always been biopics, but what was interesting about that sort of Paul Muni, Edward G. Robinson phase of the biopic was how first Warner Brothers and then it spread to other studios, but how they were able to make sort of box office gold out of movies about scientists and inventors and writers, things that were not very adventurous or exciting in terms of, you know, watching people in a lab work with test tubes and on their microscope. And they managed to use the basic elements of melodrama and, you know, good and evil and the villains trying to stop our hero and people showing courage and determination or adding young love subplots, how they were able to turn these stories into box office gold. Now, you could say they simplified them and they fictionalized a lot of the elements, but they also made a lot of people know a little something about these issues, these heroes. And it's just kind of a fascinating moment. We never hear any more today of, you know, some top actor is going to play Louis Pasteur. It's just not going to happen.
No.
And I'm not saying it should happen, but I give them a lot of credit for expanding the kinds of things they brought to audiences. True, there was no television yet. Still, they brought a lot of knowledge, even if it wasn't the whole truth, nothing but the truth. It was some of the truth, and as I said, I give them a lot of credit. Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet is a particularly good one with Edward G. Robinson.
Love it.
And so I just thought that was an interesting moment when there was so much put into that particular genre and how Muni and Edward G. Robinson and Spencer Tracy, these people sustained it for pretty much a solid decade of that kind of movie.
Yeah, I love that Magic Bullet. It's syphilis, and then you had written down what is her name? Maria?
Maria Uspenskaya gets to say syphilis.
Yeah. I've never seen that. I'd love to see that.
Yes.
And then you write about Devotion, which was about the Bronte sisters.
Yeah, that's the again, movies about writers. Again, another thing where it's hard to write, make a film about people sitting in, you know, at a desk. So the focus is on their brother, I guess, his alcoholism played by Arthur Kennedy.
I like him a lot. He's another. Yeah, I think you know, he's done such great work.
Yeah. But Ida Lupino is awfully good.
Yes,
she's awfully good. It's again, that one borders too much on soap opera, but Ida Lupino gives it a little more class.
Yeah, and there's our Paul Henry. Isn't he like a preacher or something? They're both hot for him.
Yeah, and they both sort of fall for him. Yeah.
How boring, I tell you. Yeah. And, you know, there's some great stuff, and I do want Paul Henry's daughter to come on the show. And he's done some great shows, so yes.
Yeah.
But in that one, you know, why would they fight over a preacher? They write all these great books. Okay, so the next one you have is Wuthering Lows, 1939, worst year, rough times.
Well, the it's sort of a joke, but it's not. I agree with everybody else who says that 1939 is the peak of the golden age of Hollywood. It's when the whole studio system was operating on all cylinders. sound was mastered, Technicolor was mastered. It's before the war changes everything in terms of content and sort of the you know, job one being morale boosting. And it's sort of like we figured out how to do this thing we created, and it's working. It's giving us optimum results. So here we are. And I just thought it would be fun to look at some of the stinkers of the year, because just because it's the greatest year in movie history doesn't mean everything that came out was great or even good.
Right.
So I thought it would be fun to focus on 10 stinkers of 1939 and just sort of have a reality check.
Okay, tell us our 10 stinkers.
Oh, I'll have to find them.
Okay, how about this? I'll tell you our 10 stinkers.
You got them?
Yes, you hated Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Oh, I didn't include that because I know that's regarded as, I don't think it's one of the 10 worst, but I just said of all the great movies of the year, that's the one I probably liked the least. But the ones I included as the 10 worst, here, I got them. Idiot's Delight, Made for Each Other, Tailspin, Ice Follies of 1939, Broadway Serenade, It's a Wonderful World, When Tomorrow Comes, The Return of Dr. X, Remember, and Balalaika.
I hated that one. Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Yeah, so they're big stars, you know, some great teams, but just movies I hate.
Yeah, and, I hate the Made for Each Other. I don't know what bugs me about it, but...
I think that's an interesting one, because that's of the 10 I just named, that actually has a pretty decent reputation, and as I report, it was on the New York Times 10 best list that year, which is hard to believe, but it's just an annoying movie. I think we don't really feel that sorry for the central couple.
No.
We don't want to be in their company. They're just irritating.
And the mother-in-law,
and they're kind of self-pitying, and then you've got the climax. Will the serum get there in time?
Yes, flying all over the country.
It seems like it's from some other kind of movie, but I just don't like anything about it. Even though I love Carol Lombard and Jimmy Stewart,
yes,
but they don't make a particularly good team in this case, and I don't really like what they have to do in it. So I think it belongs there.
I agree. The Return of Dr. X. That's a bogey movie.
Yeah, poor Bogey, basically in a horror role, and you feel so sorry for him. You can't imagine he's got things like The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca just a few years away. It must have been such a depressing moment for him to think, I can't believe I'm in this B-horror movie with a white streak down my hair like Elsa Lanchester.
That's what they always do when guys are electrocuted and come back to life. They have that white streak.
Right. Stoking a rabbit. It's real. I feel so sorry for him. And it's ridiculous. It's a silly movie.
It really is. 1940 costume pictures.
I just thought it would be interesting to focus on costume pictures, because in the old days, Hollywood used to sort of titillate young people's fantasies of adventure and excitement by going to the past. Nowadays, it's only in the future. We hardly ever go into the past. And so I just wanted to harken back to times when you go to the movies to be excited by pirates or Robin Hood or, the Charles II's court or the Three Musketeers, all these things that we don't really see so much anymore. But it was, again, that was a basic genre for the movies, was to make costume pictures of, fabulous times of the past and get lost in these worlds that existed. And we don't really do very much of that anymore. So it was fun to sort of revel in that. And particularly in the 40s when it's, most of them are in color, and it's just a particularly splendid moment for that genre.
Yeah. I'm trying to think here. So I'm looking at this costume picture. Oh, this one's interesting. Yankee Doodle Daffy.
Yeah, well, it's again, the sort of duality. You've got movies dealing with World War II, is part of the morale boosting that Hollywood took so seriously, but they're also kind of escapist. And so it's a weird thing of giving America the war on the screen, but treating it like a comic book sometimes, or just a crazy adventure, something like Desperate Journey with Errol Flynn and Ronald Reagan, where they, you know, they're in Germany, a couple of allied soldiers, and they're killing Nazis left and right, and it's fun, and it's the easiest thing in the world, and don't worry, we're all going to be fine, because these charming rakes are over there in Germany knocking off Nazis.
And then during Guns N' Roses, yeah.
You don't believe a minute of it,
yeah.
And yet the audience ate it up, and it was sort of giving them what was happening at the moment in a fictionalized way, and yet making it go down very easily and certainly not scaring anybody. Of course, there were more serious World War II movies made during the war, but this particular genre was really about, in a way, taking your mind off it while you were dealing with it.
Yeah, and they had, like, Lifeboat, Desperate, which was, like, you know, just sort of cavalier in a way, like with Tallulah Bankhead. Oh, darling, my mink coat. Oh, my jewels went over the cover. And here there's 10 of them. I always wonder, where do they go to the bathroom? That's just me. I don't know why.
Yes,
but,
yes.
You know, it's just like they make this lightness, you know, she did, or it's like some comedic thing. And there's nothing funny. I mean, they just got bombed, and hundreds of other people are dead, and they're throwing people off the lifeboat. So, you know, that I agree with you on that. That is just really awful.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyways, it's just a weird moment in time, because you really, in a lot of ways, you couldn't deal with the war in more serious terms while it's happening. So if morale boosting is job one, this was, I guess, in some ways a logical way to go to address it, but to keep things hopeful and as upbeat as possible. Sort of aim it even at younger audiences. And some of those are, you know, with good and evil twin spies and that kind of thing, or
the one with the invisible man.
Yeah. The invisible man's on our side, not their side. I mean, crazy stuff, but they did this stuff. I can understand its function, wacky as it may seem.
I love this. Nazi agent shot Lassie in the paw. I never knew that. That's horrible.
Yeah, the son of Lassie, that's a while. Yeah, even when the Nazis are mean to Lassie, then you know that's the last straw,
right.
I guess, for young moviegoers.
Yeah, they're bad. Yeah, so. You know then.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so we're here at Making House Calls, Hollywood in the Home Front.
Well, there are 10 home front movies, and this is another subgenre of the World War II movies. And, of course, movies about the home front, and that's basically it, which was basically Hollywood's way of telling America how to behave on the home front while the soldiers are fighting overseas. And so offering guidelines or cautionary tales or, again, the codes of behavior, modes of behavior, to say follow the guides of Claudette Colbert in Since You Went Away, if you want a model of how to handle this.
I like that very much. Did you like
– yeah.
I'm reading that. I love – she's one of my favorite actresses, Claudette Colbert.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was, again, another part of Hollywood's morale boosting was to address the home front. To address what we should all be doing while this is going on, and we may be feeling helpless, but we can do something. And usually there are characters in those movies who do the wrong thing. So
Agnes Moorehead.
Yeah, Agnes Moorehead is the bitch, the gossip.
And she only wants to go to the parties.
Yeah, she wants to make no sacrifices. But all those movies have those characters, and so... but primarily they're telling you to focus on the right people and do as they do. And maybe you can relate to this story wherever you live, because they're usually set in anywhere, America, so it can sort of connect to the most people.
Or Mrs. Miniver. I don't think...
Yeah, well, that was the model for the home front picture. Even though it's Britain... It really was the sort of standard for all the American versions that followed. if we could only be like Greer Garson, you know, we'll all be fine.
Did you notice this? This is something. Even before I knew she married her son after the movie, I could see her making goo-goo eyes sort of at him through the film.
In the movie?
Yes. Check it out if you guys watch it again.
All right.
You see how she is looking at her son. And then they didn't stay married long, and I guess he treated her really bad. He told her she was an old bag and things like that. He was lots younger, but not that much younger.
Yeah.
Poor her. I loved, you know, this land is mine is, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I liked it. Had Charles Laughton and Maureen O'Hara, and the Nazis had infiltrated, you know, just a small town in Europe. They didn't tell us where.
Yeah.
And Charles Laughton was a coward, and Maureen O'Hara didn't know her brother. What's that guy's name? Kent Smith? He was a freedom fighter.
Yeah, Kent Smith.
And, you know, of course it ends up that our darling Charles is not a coward. He is brave.
Yeah.
And that was good.
Right. So, yeah, so many of those, they'll show someone like that who doesn't think they have the stuff to show you that you may not think you have the stuff, but you really do. If you're pushed, you too will behave in the right way. And, again, that's morale building. You know, you can do it. You know, we can do it.
If he can do it, we can do it. And then you see like somebody like George Sanders, who is, you know, he gives people up and he's a coward where everybody thinks he's strong. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks, of course, Charles Laughton, who's in love with Maureen O'Hara. That mother. Oh, his mother.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Oh, yeah. Who knows? Connor. Yeah.
She's a riot.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we're going here to, what are we on next? Oh, The More the Merrier. Was that in that one?
Oh, no. I've written about that in another book, but that doesn't... I'm sure I mentioned it in passing, but that's not in this one. But
okay, so you have Lights Out, The Nocturnal Emergence of Film Noir.
Yeah, one of the... of course, the things that come out of World War II is film noir, which is partially kind of a reaction to... a new world, a darker world, a post-atom bomb world, a kind of fatalistic viewpoint about the things we learned about the Axis powers, about, I guess, war in general for this particular generation. And some of that darkness pervades, you know, basic detective stories, basic murder mysteries. It sort of gives it a sort of new depth, you know, particularly into something like Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum, one of the best ones.
And I also love Robert
Mitchum. They're very
Mitchum,
much, about the late 40s. They're very much about where the world was at in this sort of new world, this post-war world.
Detour gets a huge, it's such a low-budget movie.
Yeah.
Tom Neill, What a Life. I've discussed it before because I had someone who wrote the Barbara Payton book, John O'Dowd, who's fabulous. But, it's funny because you say she has not one attractive feature. She's really home. I don't know if it's the print, but I also said, what? She has got, she's a shrew. There's not one. And she is like homely, labonely. And you're the only other person who I think says it out loud with me, but they've got to think that too, please. You know, I'm sure she's lovely. I talked to, Eddie, what's his name from TC?
Eddie Muller.
I talked to him and he met her and said she was lovely. And of course, I would never say she was homeland when Eddie Muller was there. I'm just saying it could be because it was a cheap movie. You know, the print wasn't good.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to say.
Okay. That's fine.
How about, this is a great one, Tension.
Yeah, Tension. Speaking of Ann Savage, one of the things about film noir is all the great actresses who got to play bad girls, you know, really awful people, but we love them because they usually have the best lines and they're so witty in their tawdry little way. And Tension has got one of the great ones, Audrey Totter, who is so awful in this movie to her husband, Richard Basehart.
Warren.
And, I mean, she's one of the lowest of the low film noir femme fatales.
But I love her.
Yeah, I love her too, and that's a particularly good, juicy, nasty role for her. So yeah, it takes a special talent to be one of those dames, and she certainly was one of them. So it was fun to write about her and tension in that chapter.
And that what cracks me up is that, you know, they do the Clark Kent thing there where Richard Basehart gets contact lenses, and all of a sudden nobody can notice him. There's the cops, and they have a picture of Richard Basehart with his glasses on, and he's in the room with them, and they don't even notice. It's just like, my.
It might not be the most plausible one, but it's got its moments.
Oh, I love it. That's all I can say. It's fun. It's a fun watch. Audrey Totter is at her best in this, and I really, really like her a lot. Screwy Hooey, the random harvest effect.
Well, sometimes one movie has such an impact on the industry that you feel it showing up in assorted ways for a long time after. And I think of Rebecca was one of them. There were so many movies that seemed like Rebecca in the 1940s. And Meet Me in St. Louis was another one. There were so many of those wholesome family musicals that came right after it. And one of them is Random Harvest, which took kind of screwy, melodramatic plotting to a whole new place, where you actually have a love triangle between two people because the guy doesn't know that the two women are the same person. And so amnesia was a big thing after that movie, but all kinds of screwy things would happen. And it felt like they were inspired by Random Harvest or sometimes trying to top Random Harvest in screwiness. And they're often very entertaining movies, but they are laughable if you described the plot to someone who wasn't watching it.
I love that movie and I cry at the end, but I get you. You know, it's the plot. Like, if you've never seen it, you go, oh, my. But I like the movie very much.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're both very charming, and they put it over, and it's a beautiful production.
Yes.
But the plot is insane.
Of course.
And so many of the ones that came right after it seem to have sort of picked up the Random Harvest mantle and said, I think I can top this in craziness. I mean, Night Song with Merle Oberon is a good example.
Dana Andrews.
She pretends she's blind, and then when he gets his sight back, she pretends to be someone else because he's never seen her. And again, it's another love triangle with basically two people, but someone doesn't know that they're the same person. So that was the one most directly inspired by Random Harvest. But there's sort of varying levels of crazy in a number of those 40s ones, like Love Letters and The Locket.
I love The Locket. I know you didn't really like her. Stolen Life. I just watched it last night, too.
Yeah.
I just don't like Glenn Ford. And why did she want to go back to him after doing all those mean things he did to her with the sister? It's like, oh, come on, honey.
It's crazy. It's crazy, but it's fun. Yeah.
Undercurrent. That was Katharine Hepburn's only.
I didn't include that one, but Undercurrent, it's just, we don't like to see Katharine Hepburn play the victim in that kind of way. It just doesn't become her, and she just was miscast.
Yeah, you don't buy it.
You just don't buy it. You wait for her to sort of take charge and fight back, and we just don't like her as she's too wimpy for Katharine Hepburn. It just doesn't work.
And she's also following, I mean, obviously she's married to an incredibly jealous man. Oh, yeah. Michael, I'm in love with Michael, his dead brother. And it's like, oh, please, of course he wants to kill you. You're telling your husband you're in love with his dead brother, weirdo.
Yeah.
So I love the story behind it because Robert Mitchum was up and coming, and he was doing four movies at the time, one of them, The Locket. And he told, she told him off saying, you have nothing, you're just good looking, blah, blah, blah. So he hated her, and he would fart, you know, in her presence class all the way. But, you know, they didn't match. And she was also way older than him at that time. I think she was about 36 when that film was made. And it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, she just does not belong there.
No, I didn't think so either. Yeah.
And so you have so we're going to biblical stuff, right? Samson and Eli brought on the Bible boom of the 50s and 60s.
What's that?
I wrote all this stuff down. What's it? It's a soapy stuff. Am I at that? Let me look at the page here. So we are here with Heaven Can't Wait, and I'm trying to find my paper with Matt. And I believe, oh, that's actually the song. One of the shows is Heaven Can't Wait. Isn't that it?
What? No, it's
Gene Tierney. Well, yeah. Gene Tierney.
Yes. But I'm saying that the title of the chapter is it's a play on that one. But the chapter is about the post-war craze for fantasy.
Yes.
Now, what we usually hear about when we talk about post-war Hollywood is the sort of new energy and sort of I wouldn't necessarily call it a craze, but this new passion for social realism. So suddenly, starting with The Lost Weekend, with its alcoholism, and smash up the story of a woman, the same thing, alcoholism, mental illness dealt with in The Snake Pit, and racism, and Pinky, and Home of the Brave, and anti-Semitism in Crossfire, and Gentleman's Agreement. We have this new interest in these issues that weren't really dealt with in this way. But at the same time, and it's almost like it's the antidote to all that, is this sort of rush of fantasy films happening at the same time, as if Hollywood was saying, if you think we've sort of let you down by getting too grim on you, don't believe that, because we still want to make you forget. We still want to send you to fantasy land. So for every Crossfire, there's a Ghost in Mrs. Muir. And so I just wanted to include this chapter because I think we forget that that was also a part of the late 1940s. It wasn't just film noir and social realism. It was The Luck of the Irish and The Bishop's Wife and The Miracle on 34th Street. It happens every spring. One Touch of Venus. There were a lot of fantasy films, and mostly aimed at adults.
Yeah.
So it's just, again, a phenomenon that doesn't get talked about as much as others.
Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid. I only
exactly.
That was a good one. The Luck of the Irish. It happens every spring. There's so much there, and you have written such a great book, everybody. I am telling you, there's so much to talk about. He's telling us about, you know, what's going on in our world up until the 70s and why certain movies are made. And he has literally 350 movies in this book that you can read.
That's right.
And do, because it is interesting. And he's a very good reviewer. And he makes me laugh. I tell you, sometimes I go, ha, ha, ha. I laugh. I think it's funny. Ho, ho, ho. Anyway, thank you so much, John DeLeo. I'm so glad we finally got to speak. And the name of his book is, I'm trying to get the thing over here. Where are you? 10 Movies at a Time, a 350 film journey through Hollywood, and a, and a, I'm sorry, and a, through.
And America.
And America. I'm so sorry, but this was a good book. Good. Thank you. I love this interview. You were great. And I want John again to talk about some of your books. You can find John DeLeo on Amazon. I'll link you up and you can see all the books he's done. He's done some good ones. And you were great. Thank you so much. You were fabulous.
Thank you, Grace. It was really fun to be with you. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. You were great. And you're a fun guest. And, you know, you were wonderful. So, well, what else can I say, everybody? This was another one of our wonderful True Stories of Tinseltown and with John DeLeo. And we finally got it together. And thank you so much, John. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we will be back soon. Thanks millions. Bye, everybody.
The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean, that's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights,
or the bride with the guy on the side,
or the ball where she gives him her all, that's entertainment.
The plot can be hot, simply teeming with sex.
A gay divorcee who is after her ex.
It could be Oedipus Rex,
where a chap kills his father and causes a lot of bother.
The clerk who is thrown out of work
by the boss who was thrown for a loss.
By the skirt who is doing him dirt.
The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment. While the jury is out, or the thrill when they're reading the will, or the chase for the man with the face, that's entertainment.
The dame who is known as the flame
of the king of an underworld ring.
He's an ape who won't let her escape.
That's entertainment. It might be a fight like you see on the screen, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen, some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gang may be waving the flag that began with a mystical hand. Hip hooray, the American way. The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.